Welcome to CMS On Air, the podcast on migration and refugee issues, brought to you by the Center for Migration Studies of New York. I'm Julieta Velasquez, CMS's Communications Manager. In just a moment, you'll hear a conversation between Mario Russell and Dora Schriero. Mario is the Executive Director of CMS, and Dora is a career public servant who has served as an executive-level administrator, a policymaker, and a Homeland Security advisor. In this episode of CMS On Air, Mario and Dora discuss the detention of migrants in the United States. Should it be used? If so, how, when, and why? Here's the conversation.
So welcome to CMS On Air, a migration podcast that looks at the issues of the day, what is happening in the migration world and what is to come, and to talk about them in a way that is frank and factual, but always keeping in mind that migration is about people, people on the move, people in communities that receive, and people who strive towards the common good. I'm Mario Russell, Executive Director of the Center for Migration Studies, and today we are delighted to have with us Dora Schriero, whose life and work have been focused on detention, and who today will speak about detention of migrants, what is, and importantly, what should be the truth and reality for that. Dora is a career public servant who has served as an executive level administrator, a policymaker, and a Homeland Security advisor. She led three state and two city criminal justice agencies and a federal office in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Dora has earned a reputation for her innovation, for her advocacy and economy. It is no surprise that she's the only woman to lead three state systems in the criminal justice arena and the first to have led these three agencies. She has taught graduate criminal justice and correction law courses throughout her career and today consults and publishes in the areas of immigration and corrections innovation and systems reform. She holds a degree from Northeastern, University of Massachusetts, Columbia, and St. Louis University. So needless to say, we know we have an expert among us today. Dora, welcome. We're delighted to have you with us today, especially today, Dora, with both President Biden and Trump making visits to the border. The question of detention, in a sense, is front and center. Should it be used? If so, how and when? And most importantly, why? Deterrence, enforcement. So to begin, Dora, can you speak a little bit about your history, your work, and your movement from working on criminal detention issues to the civil detention of migrants? And importantly, can you explain why and how it is that migrants who have not committed criminal offenses are being detained?
Okay. And if I forget one or two of those things, I know you'll remind me. Thank you for this opportunity and this great treat to be speaking with you and everybody in the audience. So I was in high school. I was a senior and I was in an AP history class. And one day they changed it up and they talked about criminal justice and corrections in particular. And that's what I call my V8 moment. You know, I was up and that's where I was going. All I knew is I wanted to get in. I preferably wanted to get out every night, but I wanted to be on the inside and helping folks work their way out to be better, stronger, smarter than they had been. It took a while to get there, but as you were kind enough to note, I've done that now in a variety of capacities. Sometimes feels like being a photographer, where sometimes you have a lens and you zoom in, and other times, you know, you lean back and you get a wide angle. And I think in all of that, I have found some ground truth. And so those are the things that we're going to be talking about today. Writing the report at the request of Secretary Napolitano as to what was immigration detention. And it was left to me to, you know, decide how that conversation would go. Is now a resource that continues to be looked at. I track it, so there are folks that are online and still going back to it as we speak. I think the outline of it, the organization of it, the bones are still very much worthwhile today.
And Dora, just to go back a second, this is something that you did with the Secretary Napolitano. Maybe just a word about context for that and when you did that report.
Oh, sure. I was first tapped by the Secretary to serve as a senior advisor on immigration and detention, as well as removal. And so I was there the first month of President Obama's first term and started on that right away. I went around the country, went to a number of facilities. I was looking primarily for those facilities that had created a lot of angst for legislators at the federal and state and local levels, as well as advocates and others. And of course, spent a lot of time within ICE talking with people and learning about their hows and whys as well. That report ultimately had what I used to refer to as five buckets, you know, five areas of focus. One was population management. Those were the big questions about, you know, who could, should not be in secure detention. Then there were also alternatives to detention, which is really a subset, but it was such a big issue. I made it a bucket of its own.
Yep.
And then, of course, there was the whole notion of detention management. Once inside, what are those core assumptions about the people in the government's custody? Mm-hmm. And in what ways can and should and must they be different than individuals who are pretrial or sentenced in the criminal justice system? I also looked at programs. What is and what was, what should be for individuals' mental health in anticipation that some number of them might be allowed into the community, and the things that we could do to improve their success in that transition. There was also programs in general and medical and other healthcare in particular. Those had been grave concerns as well. And then special populations, where I could take a more particularized look at segments of the population so as to further evaluate and then to moderate or modify those conditions to meet their needs as well. The thing that I thought was most important and the part that, you know, I think we will touch on today is accountability, you know, which is a core responsibility of government. It's, what do you do? How do you do it? And what do you convey about it to others? Where are the opportunities to improve? And to what extent do you take advantage, full advantage, of those opportunities?
And so the report or the study that you did that kind of yielded these five buckets, these were with respect to detention of all or migrant detention, Dora?
Oh, this was specific to immigration detention.
Immigration detention, right. If you step back from there for a minute, Dora, even before you get to the question of right accountability, what did you come out with in terms of a recommendation about who should be detained and why? What was the question about that population that you answered?
Yeah, so my view is that detention is overutilized, and also, quite frankly, so are alternatives to detention. You know, it's fundamentally a continuum of control that goes from more restrictive to less restrictive. But as ICE has approached things, most things are done in the most restrictive, and so to taxpayers, also, you know, the most costly way of doing things. One of the things that strikes me and that I make a point to mention regularly is that even those individuals in the immigration system who may have had some criminal incarceration in their history, mm-hmm. once in the civil immigration system, they are appreciably different. They know why they are there. They also have a frame of reference as to what to expect in an incarceral setting. And so it really needs to be different. Unfortunately, the case law is not as strong here as I would like it to be, right, where there were hard and bright lines. But through standards and through a report such as this, we can create those expectations and then live up to them.
So backing up a second there, within that, out of curiosity, I was looking at some statistics for detention in February 2024, so where we are today, and note that about 38 or 39,000 people are in ICE detention currently, and about, it seems, two-thirds don't have a criminal record. Now, first of all, I would ask you, do you think that statistic that comes out of Syracuse University, the track,
yeah.
Is that, well, And then the second question there, following up on your question on, or your observation about, sort of the overuse of detention and even, taking out from that detained population, the one third who, let's say, have criminal convictions of some sort, which tend to, in fact, be minor offenses for the most part. But how do we understand, how do you understand and make sense of the logic of either our government's application or legislation around then the detention of those 66%, right, who are just there in some kind of, what is it, a message about enforcement or deterrence? What's that about, if you can get to that question?
Yeah, so I'm going to give you a little bit of background, and then I'm going to answer the question. I'm so glad you asked this, because I've got some data that I was online this morning, so mine's hot off the press.
Super fun.
The thing about enforcement personnel is they believe in enforcement. You know, if you're a carpenter, you like hammers and nails. And if you're a surgeon, you know, there's the scalpel. And there's no harm in enforcement people being enforcement people. The issue is whether or not enforcement people are really the right people to be handling this population by and large. Mm-hmm. And as long as you believe enforcement, then you believe in detaining everyone for whom you have a bed. And when you run out of beds, then you're going to put them in one of these ATDs, abbreviation for alternative to detention. So there a little bit more about the track information that I think really speaks to what happens when you have enforcement personnel versus in the corrections arena, where, you know, they're supposed to be selected for a different temperament and provide, you know, different kind of skills training so as to achieve a different result. The presumption being that most people are going to be released. How do you want them when they are? ICE has a number of different indicators, and they work at odds with each other. I looked at, they don't aggregate a lot of things, I think, in part because they don't really want you to know, but that's my own thought. But I looked at Eloy, which is a facility that I had been to before I actually took office. I was still working in Arizona as the head of the Department of Corrections. And so I looked at their data. They're one of the largest facilities right now. And 93% of the population as of now has a zero threat level. They present no risk whatsoever. And that's the no, you know, no criminal history of any kind, not only convictions, but arrests. And yet ICE has identified that 70% of them are subject to mandatory detention. You know,
So staying with that, can you tease that out a little bit? What's the relationship between then, right, a 93% zero threat level, which I guess we sort of talk about sort of the risk factor, perhaps. Maybe I've got that not quite right. But how does that then, in your mind, those two pieces that, as you said, are potentially in contradiction to each other?
They are. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, there's a lot of discretion that's afforded the agents, and they utilize that discretion. There's a lot of studies when it comes to like assessing their risk. that they have on a number of occasions modified objective assessment instruments, and when all of that didn't result in a decision to make a decision to detain, regardless of the risk score that they got, they ultimately, the decision was everyone should be detained no matter what the score. And so I'm concerned that mandatory detention as it's written in statute and then how it's actually executed are likely to be out of alignment. There's no other way that I know of to explain that.
In other words, the statute and the risk assessments are not out of alignment. And then there's also the discretionary piece that gets in the way as well.
Absolutely.
So what would you change there, Dora, as a recommendation? If you had to say, I have a magic wrench and I'm going to change this bolt and I'm going to tweak this other one, what would be those two that you, right in that space that you would say are recommendations?
I would do a couple things, and I know it's radical and it would be frightening to people who are in those positions, but I really believe that the decisions about what to do people while they are pending adjudication through EIOR, the immigration courts, is that that this really ought to be, it is its own discipline. It ought to be recognized as its own discipline, and that the decisions about where people are placed for how long and under what circumstances really ought to be something separate and apart within DHS. I ultimately don't see another way to accomplish these things. It would really be to pull out parts of ICE and CBP, because many of these decisions originate there, and give them perhaps to a more kindred spirit, which could be CIS.
Interesting. Almost taking detention decisions out of the enforcement frame in some way. And I guess you give it a different name or give it a different set of people who think about this from a different perspective or a different lens.
When you think about the criminal justice system, there are a lot of decision makers, you know, from the moment that the police officer puts their hand on someone's shoulder, whether or not whether or not to detain, arrest, you know, give a ticket, a warning, or just let them walk, you know, all the way through, there are lots of decision makers. Mm-hmm. And everyone who has discretion loves to have it. They're just mad as heck that everybody else can also exercise discretion. But right. In all of that, you know, there's a balance, and what immigration is lacking is that balance, that the different perspectives based on different levels of expertise.
So that's very important, and I think that's, you know, Dora, it's been a general criticism of much of what happens in the immigration context is, you know, this sort of disconnection between the individual, in a sense, adjudicative needs of a person and the adjudicators being straitjacketed. I mean, certainly it's a problem even at the highest level, right, within the asylum system, where there's so little wiggle room for people to express more fully what their reasons for leaving and escaping their country and finding basis for protection, so that there isn't much room in which a judge can or an adjudicator can make a decision. And I appreciate your point here. To take that a step further, and maybe again now entering sort of turning the lens, if you will, of your observation or into the social and broader political sphere, wouldn't a critic at this point say, well, thank you for your suggestion, Dora, but guess what? Under a system like that, then what you're essentially ensuring is that those, you know, those 93% that, you know, had a zero threat level, you know, all those people will be released. And who knows into what kind of alternative to detention system. And so the system collapses, because in fact, then there is really no enforcement or teeth behind the American immigration legal system that serves to leverage and discourage people from coming or staying too long. So the critics would say that, right? Or at least in part, that would be something that they would say.
Probably not so politely, but yeah, I expect so. You know, I think I would say two things to that. First of all, much like corrections at the local, state, or federal level, you know, there's a continuum of control that goes from pretrial to which could be in the community or in a facility. And there's some fluidity going back and forth in that system. And then going back to the principle of risk again and how to mitigate it is that that risk and compliance is not static. It's fluid and it changes over time. And that's why your assessments need to be accurate and they need to be timely. And also one of the pieces of data that I saw going online today is, ICE, in my view, is over managing people, both through detention and also through the alternatives. And as an alternative, they're keeping them on an ATD. Now the average is 532 days, I think. I mean, when alternatives were created and they started first in Great Britain, the intent was this was in lieu of incarceration and for very short periods of time. Dosage is a big issue. And that ICE has now some 194,427 folks as of today in the community on supervision. What a stunningly large number. I mean, think about that. This is going on today, and less than 1% failed to report for all of the regularly scheduled appearances before the immigration court. Now that goes up as you get to the final time that you're going to appear and you're going to receive the right. court's determination. At that point, it's 9%. And so risk, as I say, you know, goes up and down. And so in some systems, it's, you know, maybe these people go back inside prior to that so that they are present, you know, with greater certainty. I think you can
sorry to interrupt you. Or when you say back inside, they go back inside where? Into detention?
Oh, I'm sorry. Either detain or take them back into detention. Talking like a jailer here, so excuse me. you know, there. I mean, I think you actually can achieve a far better result. Again, when you use the science and then derive informed decisions, you know, from that.
One of the difficulties that it seems to me always in moving forward some kind of broader reform is perhaps because there isn't this idea that at the end of the deportation process, there is some kind of assurance or insurance that a negative outcome means what it means. As someone who practiced, of course, in the field for 25 years, I can acknowledge that this is an unanswered question, even among the advocates, which is to say, at the end of year 7, if a proceeding takes 7 years, or at the end of year 5, if a proceeding takes 5 years, which it can, which is, we'll agree, is a terribly structured dysfunction in the American system. That any adjudication should take that long, but it does, it can. And by then, what we call in immigration court, the respondent has potentially developed roots that are fiscal, you know, economic, real estate, job, marriage, and perhaps children in school, right? They've built a life. If the only question of risk and risk assessment has to do with flight. In other words, not showing up for the final hearing or whatever happens or should happen after the final hearing. That, I think, is the hardest question. How do you answer that? And I think I heard you say that maybe they go back in, and I want to make sure I heard you correctly, but what's the answer to that? And I'll say one last thing is that that's where I think when the administration, and this administration, I think, rightly attempted to develop a program which is not quite coming to fruition, but to adjudicate asylum claims within a year, and to really have a fair and efficient adjudication, which basically means fair and fast. There's still no answer as to what happens on the no side, right, when the judge denies it. Mm-hmm. And the last thing we'd want to see is people detained in court with a negative decision. But what is, do you think, procedurally the answer to that? And I say this to you as an expert on detention, and maybe I'm asking you to sort of pull the lens so far back that you have, you know, the most incredible answer to how we solve this quandary.
Yeah, well, I was expecting you not to ask whether or not they be detained at the time that opinion is rendered, mm-hmm. But in anticipation that there might be a bad outcome is ordinarily where someone would be detained. Or put under some more rigorous form of community supervision. Doesn't always have to result in detention per se. That might be the opportunity when you would do electronic monitoring, and right. Not from Jump Street as is the case, you know, today. But there's one of the things that the literature has shown over and over again is having an attorney or someone else who continues to provide advice. So it could be some community-based provider with, you know, similar expertise to, you know, to provide information. It doesn't require the law degree per se, but it's the constant communication that really is instrumental in the appearance, especially as one gets closer to, you know, the thumbs up, thumbs down. And so it's not a call for everyone to have an attorney, but to maximize utilization of the resources that are in the community, and perhaps to grow those resources some more as well.
I think that's really crucial. And in that sense, I think you're right. It's like sometimes the answer is not necessarily in the modality that we're in conversation about now, which is detention, but is in fact on a host of other things that run on parallel tracks that don't get enough attention. Like you said, information, access to legal information, jobs, better lawyers, and a shorter process, right? Mm-hmm. I think a shorter Absolutely. Process gives people a little bit more autonomy over what their life decisions are about, right? Because once 7 years have passed, that's nearing a significant percentage of a person's lifetime. So the investment there is so significant. Dora, I want to kind of close with a last terrible question to you, but you know, we're in an election year, and it's never an ordinary election year when you have the candidates that are before us, and particularly Mr. Trump and his team of advisors who, it seems, have already begun to discuss their strategy around immigration, though we've not seen it in writing. Again, the list is long of things that are alarming and concerning, but one of them, of course, is the intention to round up, to use that language, all the undocumented in the United States, whether at the border or in interior, which now we know from a report that CMS just published on 2022 data has gone close to 11 million, up by about 650,000. And I anticipate once the 2023 numbers are in, that will be close to another million. So those numbers are rising of people who are deeply, deeply vulnerable to this kind of executive action. In your world as an expert who looks at sort of the management of detention and the realities around it. How would you give, a three bullet answer to Mr. Miller and Mr. Trump about why detaining and holding 11 million people is just an absolutely failed experiment on any number of grounds, whether economic, social, humanitarian, and other?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think either of those gentlemen use those criteria to measure success. So I think they would be motivated, not thwarted, unfortunately. But having said that, to the extent that there is to be detention, and hopefully ideally for, the fewest number of people and not the greatest just cause, and there's no just cause about that, of course, playing on the words. Mm. But one of the things that's so remarkable about this population, and this includes those who are even criminal aliens, is that they have community ties, and they also have skills. And and so to the extent that there is detention, my recommendation is that it is as normal as life can be. They are not institutionalized. There is no reason to operate those facilities as if they are institutions. Mm-hmm. They can prepare their own breakfasts. They certainly want to take care of their own children, parent their own children. They can do their laundry. And if there was an opportunity to grow fruits and vegetables, they would do that as well. So I would lean in on the competencies which they bring with them rather than take it all away and then start grousing because it costs us all so much.
That's right. Right. Well, I think we are in need of your thoughts and your imagination in case we get there. And I think so much of this will have to do with convincing the public as well. So I think there's a lot of work to do now and potentially after, we hope not. Dora, anything else you wanted to add before we head out for the day?
Oh, gosh, thank you. No, I guess. One, we haven't talked about families in particular. But, when you talk about, opening your arms to some 11 million or however many, whatever imaginary number they're going to make up next, I mean, there are going to be a lot of families in that. And, I think we've learned some really difficult lessons the hard way. And I would encourage everyone to be especially mindful of the impact on the children. CMS has done some tremendous stuff there. You were kind enough to publish an article I wrote, which had to do, it was titled Weeping in the Playtime of Others, and then a podcast that followed. But I'd sure be extra mindful for the families and those little boogers that would otherwise be in them with their moms and dads.
Dora, you bring a human touch and a humanitarian consciousness to this that is really special and unique. So thank you for that. Thank you for your very, very important insights. And I think thank you for helping sort of frame this a little bit and humanize the question. We definitely do have to do a lot of work on this. So I hope you stay involved. So thank you for joining us for today. And that's it for us today from CMS On Air. Thank you.
To learn more about CMS's research, upcoming events, or for a full transcript of this episode, please visit www.cmsny.org. CMS On Air's theme music is provided by The Music Case. For more podcasts like this one, please follow CMS On Air on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.